Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 68, an interview with Carl Kessel. Carl Kessel's been working in comics since the 80s. Since the mid-80s, back when I was in college, I read his stuff. And then when I started working at Shinders was when the Hawk and Dove miniseries came out. And that's where I really just kind of learned about his stuff. He wrote the Hawk and Dove miniseries, and he wrote the Hawk and Dove series after that. He also worked on Superman during Superman's big boom period, during the death of Superman. Is the creator of the 90s Superboy. And has worked on a bunch of different projects. And one of the things about his work that I've always enjoyed is that he honors the past while creating new for the future. And one of the things that he's doing in this interview is pushing a Kickstarter for the return of Section Zero, which was part of Guerrilla Comics in the year 2000. And Section Zero was a book that he and Tom Grummett did. Only three issues came out. And now they are doing a trade paperback to finish up that first story and probably kickstart a new series. And if you go to the show notes, there's a link to it. But we talk a lot about Section Zero. We talk a lot about his entire career. And I really think you'll enjoy this episode. And I got to be honest, I've seen your work probably about as long as you've been in comics, because I actually remember... I remember seeing your name in New Talent Showcase back in the 80s.
That was the beginning. That was the start, yeah.
And you, one of the things that's always seemed to go through your work, and I want to talk, because I'm such a big Kirby fan, you've always had this big Kirby influence, bringing back characters that other people weren't using, trying to get that same kinetic style, and even when, during the big amalgam thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You probably did the only Kirby-esque Spider-Man story that ever has been printed. Because even when Kirby did Spider-Man, it didn't really feel like Spider-Man.
Right, right. No, I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, yeah. So, well, I'm glad you liked it. I mean, I actually, Spider-Boy is a very fond memory for me, too. I really enjoyed working on Spider-Boy.
And what I wanted to talk about first was you were part of the group that did Guerrilla Comics.
Yes, I was, along with Kurt Busiek and George Perez and Mark Waid and all those other talented people.
And one of the things about that line that really jumped out at me, not just that it was creator-owned, but it was at a time when we were kind of pulling out, finally, of that grim, gritty, late 80s, 90s thing. And you guys all kind of had this feel that you were kind of bringing the fun back to comics. Mark Waid on The Flash, Kurt Busiek on Astro City, and the other books that he was doing. And you, on the Superman books, were the guy who was, well, let's go back and pull some of that stuff out of the Jimmy Olsen that Kirby did.
I will admit I had a great fondness for that, but you know, in many ways I was following in Jerry Ordway's footsteps. He had a huge fondness for that too.
And I wanted to ask, when you were on the Superman stuff, Jerry Ordway brought it in, and you kind of continued that and kept using it. Was it something where editorial was like, you know, here are these characters, it's okay to use, or were you the one in the writers' meeting going, I want to use this, and I want to use this, and I want to use this?
Yeah, it was a case of me wanting to use them. I don't think there was any editorial decree to bring in, you know, the Guardian and the Newsboys and such. I mean, quite honestly, I had an idea for a Goody Rickles story. Well, I would have called him Good Guy, but it would have been Goody Rickles. That would never quite made it past the smell test. But
So you're telling me that the editor who once gave us Dirk McGurk didn't want to bring back Goody Rickles.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all have, maybe it's a timing thing. Let's say it was a timing thing. So, but no, I've always had a fondness for that. I've always had a fondness for the kind of more wacky side of Kirby or you know, a lot of characters. I mean, quite honestly, one of the things I loved about DC's 60s characters was, you know, all these books would last 5, 6, 7 issues and go away, and they were the weirdest characters. I loved all that stuff.
And I think the book where you finally kind of became a name, if there is such a thing, was one of those kind of obscure characters with Hawk and Dove.
Yep, there's another one. Lasted, what, 7 issues in the 60s? Yeah.
Yep. And you did the miniseries and then the regular series far surpassed what Ditko had done. Tell me a little about how you pitched that to DC back, kind of, it was like post-crisis. And they'd done a thing where Hawk and Dove, Dove had died.
Dove had died in Crisis, that's right.
So they were kind of, were they looking for a new Hawk and Dove, or was it, they just were kind of throwing out ideas and anybody who grabbed it could grab it?
Well, I mean, at the time, as I remember it, you know, and quite honestly, I'll admit, a lot of the way Hawk and Dove happened, I think, was sheer naivete on my part. I didn't know how series and ideas were approved. And so I just kind of steamrolled ahead, and I was, you know, married to Barbara Randall Kiesel at the time. She was an editor at DC. She certainly knew how to get things looked at by Dick and the people in the right places. And we did co-write the Hawk and Dove series and miniseries. But I mean, I really had no idea how you got these things approved. My impression was at the time that they were looking to expand. They were looking for new ideas, especially new takes on old characters, older characters. And, the idea of a female Dove seemed like a no-brainer to me. And you know, so much of this industry is timing and being in the right place at the right time. And that was an idea in the right place at the right time.
And you were inking at the time, and I can't think of a lot of inkers before that who had also been writers. I think Bob Layton did some plotting.
Yeah, and Terry Austin. Terry Austin wrote
Cloak and Dagger, but then they didn't seem to let him write anything after that, which is a shame, because his Cloak and Dagger was so fun.
Yeah, it was. It was very good, yeah. So, and I mean, you know, I think, obviously, like any industry, I do think you can get pigeonholed in comics, and it was very hard for me to move beyond just inking. I mean, if Barbara was not involved, you would have not have seen that Hawk and Dove. I don't think they would have given me a chance. I think they wanted to know trained writer was like steering the ship, and that was, you know, Barbara was there to help with that. But after a while, you know, I did get my sea legs, and I did get chances to do some of my own work, and you know, the rest is my career, basically.
And you were involved in what is probably the biggest comic story of the 90s. I think, didn't Dan Jurgens buy a house with Superman 75?
He very, very well could have. Of course, I did not come in until it was time to bat cleanup. And,
right.
And honestly, when they offered me the job, no one knew what was down the road. You know, Jerry had decided, you know, he had done his bit with Superman. I think if Jerry had known what was coming, he would not have walked away from that job. You know, I'm eternally grateful to both Jerry and Carlin. I mean, I would have no career without Mike Carlin. They gave me a huge chance, and it changed my life.
And you also created the new Superboy, which, you know, after Crisis, you know, there's not going to be a Supergirl, there's not going to be a Superboy, there's not going to be a Krypto, there's not going to be any of that. And then the Superboy kind of spun out of that Death of Superman. What was involved in that Superboy pitch?
Well, I mean, you know, we were all just coming up with different versions of Superman that could appear in the books. The idea was, we'd all come up with different possible ways to bring Superman back from the dead. But I think a number of us, I know I certainly had the idea that maybe more than one guy showed up saying he was Superman. And I know when I walked into that first Superman summit, cause that was the first summit I ever went to, Mike Carlin was already saying there's going to be 4. So, and I'm not saying he got that idea from me. I'm saying that I think great minds were thinking alike, or, you know, I was thinking like a great mind, maybe, I don't know. But I had the idea that, you know, the four books could have four Supermen, and, you know, my basically idea was to look at the titles of the books and figure out what Superman would fit. And, you know, so I was thinking, well, Man of Steel, maybe that's like a robot. And Action Comics, I actually thought they should bring back a Superman who is very much like the original Siegel and Shuster Superman, someone who can only leap, you know, a quarter of a mile, who can, you know, bursting shells, can, you know, burst his skin. You know, I thought that sort of character could be really fun to explore. And I always figured the Superman book would have Superman, the real Superman. And I was even stymied myself for a while for what Superman would appear naturally in The Adventures of Superman. And I was like, And then I suddenly remembered the old tagline, The Adventures of Superman When He Was a Boy. That's what they used to call the Superboy book. And then I thought, that's who's in this, The Adventures of Superman. It's Superboy. And that's how I walked into the summit. Although I will say, when we were all throwing ideas on the table, I was being, you know, I was getting used to the feel of the room, and Dennis Jahnke was the first person to say Superboy, and Carlin wrote it up on the board. And when we all got down to divvying up who got what, I did make a pitch for Superboy to be in Adventures of Superman, and Wheezy Simonson, once again, this is a moment that changed my life. Wheezy Simonson said that Tom and I could do Superboy. She, you know, because Dennis, as the inker of Man of Steel, you know, kind of had a claim to that. He was the guy who put that name on the board.
Okay. And that was that the first time you worked with Tom Grommet?
Yeah, I believe so. Although Tom and I have there's a weird synchronicity in our life, because twice before, I had I've once been up at the DC offices, and an editor of a book called Secret Origin, a man named Mark Waid, pulled me aside and said, "Carl, I got this guy. I think he would be great inking him. Look at this guy." And it was this pencils to the Secret Origin of Animal Man, pencil by Tom Grummet. Now, I did not ink that story. I don't know if it was already assigned or if I was too busy or what, but I remember seeing the pencils thinking that they were gorgeous, that they were really beautiful. So, but, you know, Mark in his head was already pairing me with Tom Grummet. And just about at the same time, and I don't remember if it was a little before or a little after, I was up at the Marvel offices. My exclusive at DC was just running out, and I was feeling the waters up there. And I was up there, and I was pulled aside by an editor, a guy who was editing a new sci-fi anthology called Open Space. His name was Kurt Busiek. And Kurt goes, "Carl, I got this great guy that I think you'd be perfect to ink. His name's Tom Grummet." And I can't remember what he showed me that Tom had done for Open Space, but he showed me something. So Tom and I didn't get to work together until Adventures of Superman, but it seems like people were trying to match us up from a very early point.
And one of the things about your inking style was that you were able to bring out all this crackling energy. You know, you were one of the first people to work with Rob Liefeld, and looking at how you inked Liefeld, you understood the energy of the pencils to kind of correct the youthful, a lot of people bash on him, but I think there's something about his art that's got energy that really connected with teenagers in that time period. Yeah. And your work on Hawk and Dove with him was kind of where his stuff just popped off the page to me. And I've seen his work by other people, and they tend to make it more scratchy, whereas you make it very smooth and almost supple as it pops off that page.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that just is my natural style and how I approach things. But you know, I do try very hard. You know, when I sometimes talk to people who want to ink, I say that as a real big part of inking to me is not just looking at what's on the page, but really trying to figure out what did the penciler intend to draw here, whether he actually drew it or not. And a lot of times, if you see someone doing, you know, trying to do a Kirby homage, pastiche, whatever, okay, you know, if you realize that and recognize it, you can push it in that direction even more, possibly. If you see someone who's doing, you know, an homage to a real famous Neil Adams sequence or something, you know, you can push it in that direction. I mean, many times you almost have to get inside the penciler's head and you know, okay, so he didn't really quite draw this crystal to look as sharp-edged as a crystal should be, but I know that's what he would like. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I do think that is a part of inking, is to enhance the pencils and once again, to make it what the penciler intended it to be, whether that's actually what they drew or not.
One of the things I've heard from pencilers is that back in the 80s, the pencils didn't have as much detail, but by the end of the 90s, pencilers were doing a lot of the detail that inkers and background artists would do, which is kind of why many artists have slowed down. As an inker, have you noticed that change as well in just generally how people are drawing comic books?
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, I started out, luckily, you know, in the 80s, there was still, I had a chance to ink George Tuska, and I inked some Kurt Swan, you know, and quite honestly, that was, you know, I didn't ink a lot of Kurt Swan, but the sketchiness of his pencils really did surprise me, because I was used to seeing, you know, the Murphy Anderson inked version in the comics. And that generation did draw much quicker, much sketchier, and as the time went on, the pencilers did become a lot tighter, a lot more exact. I mean, John Byrne isn't a very exact penciler. I mean, he includes, you know, even line weights for his figures in many cases, and in many cases, he's absolutely right. He knows what he's doing. But I know in the early 2000s, I was inking some beautiful pencilers, and I don't know how they were working on a monthly book, and in most cases they weren't, because it was taking me a day and a half to ink some of their pages, and they were gorgeous pages. Lan Medina is an artist I'm thinking of specifically. I think his first name's Lan. I hope I have that right. And he did some Minimum Carnage with a miniseries he did that I inked a lot of, and those pages are so gorgeous, and they took me days to ink pages of that book. Yeah.
It was also in the mid-90s where you did, I think, one of the most criminally underrated runs of any comic, and you came on to Daredevil when Daredevil was just kind of a mess. They'd lost their way, he was wearing armor, and you kind of came in and went back to the Stan Lee sort of, he's a swashbuckler.
Right.
You had Gene Colan.
Oh, tell me, that was a dream come true to do an issue with Gene Colan. I actually even got to ink one of his covers, which I was so thrilled about. That's one of the high points of my career.
And that run was just so much fun, because it, again, it was kind of an antidote to the everything is horrible, everything is dark, the hero must have unrelenting obstacles put in their way, no supporting cast, no fun. You kind of came in and made the book fun again. Did they choose you because you were bringing that in? Or did you bring that in because they let you run wild with it?
No. I will tell you quite honestly, Bob Harris specifically wanted me to bring Daredevil at that point back to its Stan Lee Gene Colan roots. That is specifically why they asked me to work on the book and specifically what they wanted on it. And then, quite honestly, I was very happy to do that. I will say, I think it is not as successful a run as I was hoping it would be. And part of that was I had not done regular work at Marvel before. And, you know, they had a slightly different way of doing things. And so sometimes I was caught off guard because, oh, that's not how things work at DC, which is where I was used to working. And so a number of the issues I'm very proud of, a number of the issues I think could have been a lot better. And, you know, quite honestly, I look at Mark Waid's Daredevil and I say, that's what I was trying to do. And Mark, you know, he's an amazing writer and he was working with amazing artists. Not that I wasn't, but I always look at Mark's Daredevil run and I think that's what I was aiming for. That's exactly what I was aiming for. And I don't think I ever quite reached that personally.
I think one of the things about Mark Waid's run is he was able to balance the swashbuckler aspect with the heavy drama aspect that I think Daredevil's now known for. I think we're now 20 years past. I don't think anybody could come in and do a Stan Lee-type Daredevil anymore. People wouldn't recognize that character.
Yeah, you're probably right. Yeah. So, the Stan Lee Gene Colan run is by far my favorite. And my absolute favorite of that is the Mike Murdock storylines. When that was the craziest comic that was out there. They were just doing the weirdest thing every month. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I loved the idea that Matt pretended to be his own twin brother. It's the craziest idea you've ever heard.
And that was back when Stan, I always see Stan stuff. You know, he had the adventure stuff, but if you look at what he signed his name on in the 50s, it was the joke books and the soap opera books.
Right, right.
It wasn't until much later that he started signing the monster books. So when he got to do superheroes, if he didn't have somebody else who was kind of driving the plot, he would just go back to that stuff he liked writing in the 50s. The corny dad jokes and the soap opera stuff. And Daredevil kind of was the only place that really felt like there were no limits, there were no controls.
I know. You never knew what was going to happen in that book, like especially in issues like 20 through 45 or something like that with the Prime. There were just the bizarrest things going on in that book.
And Gene Colan was just whatever movie he'd seen that day, he wanted to put it in the book. And it makes it so much fun to read.
Yeah. Yeah, so, no, I loved it.
When you worked at both DC and Marvel, what do you think was the big difference? What did DC do best and what did Marvel do best from a creator standpoint?
Oh, gee, that's hard to say because, like I said, I did 15 issues or whatever it was of Daredevil, but I really don't have a ton of experience, especially over an extended period of time at Marvel. I've done little runs here, miniseries there, and so I've never really gotten a feel for, you know, the way Marvel does it. And quite honestly, I think the way Marvel does it now has changed from the way it used to be done in the 90s. I actually think probably DC now, considering Bob Harris is now the editor-in-chief, probably runs a lot more like Marvel used to run in the 90s. These companies do change over time. What they're looking for, the editorial process, the editorial amount of editorial direction changes. I think it's much more now than it used to be. But I don't know if I can really tell you what the difference between Marvel and DC was in the 90s. I just didn't have that much experience with Marvel.
Okay. There were two other books at Marvel that I wanted to hit on. One was one that, again, came out of one of those dark, gritty runs where you just kind of turned on the lights, and that was Fantastic Four 2099. It didn't run very long. But all the other 2099 stuff was very, you know, the world is run by corporations and things are bad. And your Fantastic Four was kind of like, if the Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, Fantastic Four showed up in that world.
Right. And that's exactly what I said to Joey when Joey Cavallari asked me if I was interested. I said, well, of course I'm interested in Fantastic Four 2099. Can it be the real FF? And the only thing he said there was, well, we can't say it is for sure, but we don't have to say it's not.
Okay.
No. And I did go back to the FF that, you know, really rang my bell, which was that old Stanley Jack Kirby stuff. And I'll tell you, I remember talking to Kurt Busiek about this because he was also doing Untold Tales of Spider-Man at about the same time. And we were both running into the same problem, which was, to really capture the pattern that Stan would write, you really had a lot of word balloons on your page.
Yes.
And, you know, to try to find a way to edit that down so it read more like a modern comic, yet still retain some of that feel, that was not an easy thing to do.
That's something that I want to ask because, you know, you've been writing this whole time, you know, I would say that the mid to late 80s was pretty much the writing style was the same as it had been since the 70s. Maybe not as much in the way of captions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's almost like it's being pared down to the minimum you can get away with. I always use the comparison when I read one of the comics that I read as a kid in the 70s, it takes a half hour. When you read one of the comics now, if you're just reading it and not, you know, drinking in the art, you can read it 5 minutes.
Yeah, no, that's true, yeah.
As a writer, has that made it much harder to try and get these ideas across?
Well, all I can say is I still basically write the way I write. And I do read a lot of comics, and I don't want to say I read a lot of comics because I actually don't. I try to, but I don't. But the comics I read, a lot of times, even comics that have gotten some really great reception in press, I read it and I go, well, this really needed a transition balloon here, or, you know, there's a certain abruptness to some of what I read today that is not to my stylistic taste, put it that way.
And as a reader, there are times I get a little confused too. And it's almost like everybody wants to do Howard Chaykin's American Flag.
Yeah.
Where he would have the stylistic shift rather than the meanwhile.
Right, right. Yeah. So, but yeah, I know what you're saying about the differences today, and I don't know. To me, it almost seems as if more and more comics are being written as if they're TVs or movies, and this quite honestly could work just perfectly fine for the modern younger reader who is so steeped in that sort of language. But I do believe comics are different, and I believe comics need a slightly different approach. Because a lot of times I'll read a comic, like I said, and I'll go, boy, that's really an abrupt moment there. And I said, now if it was on TV and we could see that side glance that the main character gives the girl, we would know what this means. But in a comic, I just find it a little underwritten sometimes, yeah.
And also with TV or a movie, if they're going to transition from scene to scene, they often give an establishing shot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, this scene has ended, here's the scene of the outside of the house, now we go into the house. And in comics, the way they've done that in the past is either stylistically or with you know, captions.
Captions, sure.
You know, even one of the most visual artists ever, Will Eisner, would use captions for changing scenes.
Right, yeah. No, I understand totally, sure. You know, what's interesting about that, though, is I don't know if you ever heard this, but Dick Sprang, His philosophy about scene changes was that when you change a scene, you open on someone's face, because a face will draw you into the scene, and then the second panel you show where the face is.
Okay.
But Dick Sprang always believed that if the first panel was the shot of the warehouse, the scene is less interesting, intrinsically less interesting. You're less drawn into it, less quickly or whatever. So he believed in opening on a face and then showing where the face is. I always thought that was interesting.
I had not heard that about him. I know that Kirby always, and it was intrinsic because I know he didn't read Elmore Leonard telling you how to do stuff, but he always started you late and left a little early.
Right. Well, I think that's the best way to do it too. Yeah. Yeah.
But another of the Marvel books that I wanted to bring up was you did Marvel Apes.
You really want to bring it up, huh?
Well, when you think DC, you think gorillas.
Right.
And, you know, that's the company that Section Zero started with. But when you think Marvel didn't really do as much with apes.
Right, right.
So was this something that they had and you came to, or did you pitch this?
No, I did not pitch this at all. Steve Wacker contacted me and said, Marvel Apes, we want to do it. I mean, this is in the after the Marvel Zombies books were so big, and I think they were looking for the next thing.
Okay.
And so a fan had I believe drawn up something, I'm not sure what it was, but an image that he showed Joe Quesada and said Marvel Apes, and Joe loved the idea. And so that was handed off to me, and there was only so I initially just told Wacker, let me think if I could even think of a story for this, and I told him if I could come up with a story that we liked, yeah, I'd be interested in doing it, you know. And I wasn't going to write up the whole story, but I wanted to see if I actually could come up with something that would hold together 4, 5, 6 issues, whatever it was. And I did come up with a story that I liked, that I thought had potential, and I handed it into Steve, and he said, "This is really great, but if I knew, you know," because I wrote up, you know, a couple pages of what the story would be. And he goes, "But if I knew you were going to do this much work, I would have told you that the apes have to be vampires." Because that was the other thing that Joe Quesada had decided, was that they weren't just apes, they were vampire apes. And no one had told me that. And I know why he did this. At least, you know, I've never talked to Joe about this. But when I first heard that, I thought that was the wackiest thing I'd ever heard in my life. And really, I just didn't know if it would work at all. But after I thought about it, I my rationale for it was, oh, Joe understands that the idea of superpowered apes is kind of silly. And so he wants to make sure that the fans understand these guys are dangerous. So he's making them vampires. At least that was my rationale. Like I said, I've never talked to Joe about it. But I really thought a bunch of apes could be really dangerous all by themselves. You know, Planet of the Apes doesn't need vampires. So I tried to walk a line there. But editorially, I was told they had to be vampires also, at least some of them.
Well, let's talk a little about Section Zero. You've got a Kickstarter going to bring back Section Zero.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
And this was a creator-owned book, part of Guerrilla Comics. And I remember when Guerrilla Comics started, it was one of those where I went, well, I'm buying all of these. You had a killer lineup of creators.
Yeah, well, there certainly was. And quite honestly, Tom and I were lucky to hitch our wagon to those stars, let me tell you.
Well, and the team of you and Tom was one that I kind of followed, because I tend to follow creative teams rather than comic characters. The 90s kind of taught me that.
Yeah, I understand, sure.
And Section Zero, you did 3 issues, but Guerrilla seemed to kind of... Now, the story out here was that your financing was through a website, and then the website didn't make it, and you tried to keep going, but eventually you had to take on other work because the Guerrilla stuff in the marketplace was very crowded at the time, and it wasn't really doing as well as more established creators and companies.
I do think there's a lot of truth in all that. I don't think it's the whole truth. I mean, you know, it was a while ago. I can't remember everything. Yes, there was supposed to be some financing. It didn't show up. A lot of us decided we would soldier on anyways. For me personally, it came down to the fact that that I got divorced in the middle there. And that was of my doing. I want to make that clear. But it also meant I could no longer work for free. I had to pay my own bills, and I had to go back to doing work for hire. And that is really the only reason we walked away, or I should say why I walked away from Section Zero, and Tom at that point had no choice but to put it up on the shelf too.
So for people, you know, it was 17 years ago.
It was.
Which, you know, we're at that age where it's like, oh, yeah, that's a kind of a newish comic.
I know what you mean.
One of the jokes I use on the show, on my regular podcast, is my co-host and I are around the same age. And he'll bring up a comic, and he'll go, oh, yeah, you know, I recently read blah, blah, blah. And I'll just go, Joe, you do realize that comic's 25 years old.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know Section Zero, give us an introduction to what the book is.
Section Zero is a secret section of the United Nations Charter that perpetually funds a team of experts and explorers to investigate the strange and unknown. And that's what they do. And they've existed since the, 1947, when the United Nations was formed. And there's been many versions of the team over the years. From the very beginning, Tom and I wanted the characters to age in real time. And we still want that. So the Kickstarter is successful, and we work on this. The very first page of the second half of the book is a splash page that says 17 years later. That's the first page of the second half of the book. And all the characters you've known 17 years have gone by. And oddly enough, we're still telling a cohesive whole story. The story that's begun in those three issues that were published, we will reprint, and the story we will tell in the second half finishes off that story, even though there's 17 years missing in between.
Now, is this going to be self-published, or are you going to be teaming with a publisher once it's funded?
No. We're just jumping into this with both feet, and so we will be publishing it ourselves. This might be the only book that comes out from this publishing house, which we are calling Panic Button Press.
Okay.
But if we're successful and this all goes together, Tom and I would love to do more Section Zero through Panic Button Press. I have other ideas with other creators I would like to do with Panic Button Press. I wouldn't be surprised if Tom would like to do something like, you know, many times he's talked about bringing back his old creator-owned book, which is called The Privateers. I don't want to speak for him, but there would be certainly a place for that in Panic Button.
And is this going to be like a trade paperback? Is it going to be a series of issues? How's it going to be sold to people?
It is going to be a collection, a trade paperback initially. If we hit our goal and then hit just a couple $1,000s more, we can go to hardcover, which personally I would like to do. I might have set our initial goal as a hardcover, but we wanted to give ourselves every chance we could of making the goal. So the lower the goal, the more chance. Although I will say we have a high initial goal, and I knew that going in. And the only reason for that is because we need to pay our bills while we're finishing off this story. And I know many times Kickstarters only cover the cost of printing and maybe some, you know, lettering and coloring, and we certainly would be paying for all of that from the Kickstarter. But Tom and I are also, we have 4 months of bills that we need to pay, and we, believe me, we will not get rich off this, but we will get by. And as I like to say, you know, our families have supported us while we pursue this. We really owe it to them to support them too. And that's why, you know, we've got a $62,000 goal, which is we're reaching, and it's not going to be an easy road, but we're pulling out all the stops.
And one of the things I think a lot of comic fans don't seem to grasp is that everything that a comic creator does is kind of part of the job. I used to run the convention here in Minneapolis, and I would tell the volunteers and other people that the artists are our guests, but to them, this is part of their job. They sell art. They sell sketches. They do this. For a Kickstarter on this, you're going to be working on a book that no publisher is going to pay you for.
Yes.
And I don't know how many pages the finished book will be, but think about, you know, if you do a page a day and it's, you know, 168 pages, that's 168 days that you can't work on another book, that you can't take another assignment for.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. And, you know, we have a huge amount of the story done already. We have something like 100 pages of art, you know, all penciled, inked, lettered, colored. That's all done. But we still have another like 60, maybe 70 pages still to go to finish off the story. You know, a number of years ago, not too many years ago, I should say, we talked very seriously to IDW about reprinting the first three issues of Section Zero, and they were going to pay for us to do two more issues. They were going to pay us very low rate to do two more issues. And I'm sorry to say, the story we need to tell takes three more issues. And there was, unfortunately, no way that could pencil out with IDW. We came very close to a deal, very close. But we need three issues worth of comics to finish off this story. Like I said, we've waited 17 years. We want to do this right. We don't want to compromise now. And so after, you know, talking to Image, talking to IDW, we decided Kickstarter looked like our best bet to actually do this the way we want to do this. And we're working close to the bone as possible. We've already got a million favors that we've called in. You know, we have people like Walt Simonson, who's doing a pinup for us. Dave Gibbons is doing a pinup for us. Chris Somney, he's already drawn his pinup. These people don't have to draw their pinup until it were funded, but Chris Somney wouldn't wait. George Perez, he's already drawn his pinup. We've got a lot of friends who've already pitched in to help us. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, you say in the Kickstarter pitch that this is kind of your tribute to Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask, when were you bitten by the Kirby bug, and how does it feed into Section Zero?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I remember loving the Fantastic Four as a kid. I started reading it around issue 80. I picked that up off the stands, and I remember really being knocked over by the Skrull Takes a Slave story. That just really, really left a huge impression on me. And, Ben taken into outer space, lands on a planet that's run by alien gangsters and put into a gladiatorial arena where he fights a living robot and other cool monsters. And I just love that. And it had two of my favorite Fantastic Four covers, which is, where the one where he's fighting the robot on the cover, and the one before it where Ben is tearing down the fight poster, which I remember even as a kid, I thought, I've never seen a cover like this. This is an amazing cover. So I think that was about the time when I realized that there's something going on with this Kirby guy that really just is electric.
And then that was toward the end of his run when he went over to DC for the New Gods.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, me as someone, I'm kind of older. I mean, I'm younger. So I discovered the New Gods when DC reprinted them in the early 80s. What was it like with that stuff just exploding on the stands every few weeks?
Well, it was astounding to see something that was on the stands every few weeks. I mean, the Marvel books were all interconnected, but the Kirby's Fourth Worlds were, it was like all just one big novel and they were different chapters. And that sort of real tight continuity over four titles, I'd never seen it before, and it really was astounding. And just the amount of ideas that were being thrown at you was almost numbing. Kirby always, but especially at that point, just threw stuff at the wall and just kept going on. He that's why so many people have made careers, myself included, about mining the ideas he laid down, because he never spent time to really explore the ramifications of a lot of what he was putting on the table.
That's one of the things about that whole New Gods run. Mike Allred's doing a 6-part bug series, which is almost like a character that Kirby said, oh, I've got this idea, I'm going to do an issue about him, and then moved on.
Yeah. Yeah, I know, exactly, yeah. So,
now, was that around the time when you decided that you wanted to do comics? When did that feed in with this?
Yeah, somewhere in there. I was probably, when I first started getting serious about comics when I was about 10 years old, which was, 69, so right about at the end of Kirby's Marvel run and right when he was starting the DC stuff, that's about when I decided I was going to be a cartoonist. So Kirby stuff obviously influenced me there. I mean, but also as a teenager, I was very influenced by Jim Starlin. I remember copying the way he drew hands and feet and knees, especially for some reason. I kind of forget what the question was that you asked.
Getting in when you decided that you were going to draw comics, it was that Kirby explosion. Did that kind of pull you in, or was it what was the influence for you to say, I love this stuff, this is what I want to do with my life?
Yeah, I can't say there was one specific moment. It was, like I said, that I know around the time I was 10 years old, I decided I want to be a cartoonist. At the time, I also remember I was reading Neil Adams' X-Men. That was leaving a huge impression on me at the time. What else was going on that I really loved at that time? The X-Men I loved, and the New Gods stuff I loved. And of the New Gods, I did like the Jimmy Olsen stuff the best. It was the weirdest, and it was the first time I was exposed to the idea of heroes without powers, which I started to get very, very, very interested in. Because up till then, every hero I'd read from Marvel, they had some sort of power, some sort of shtick. And then, at this point I was definitely into comics. I was definitely going to make it my career. But it was when I went to the Kubert School that I read a collection of Kniff's Terry and the Pirates. And that was like, my mind was blown because, these guys had no powers, no costumes, and it was some of the most gripping comics I'd ever read in my life.
And the art style by Kniff is very different from the comic style, especially Kirby, which is much more kinetic.
Yeah, that's very true. Kniff didn't have the space that Kirby had for the large moments. So his stuff was much more atmospheric, and I think by... because of the nature of the comic strip, Terry is much more about suspense than action. So.
And you're at the Kubert School. Was this very early on in the Kubert School? And who were some of the teachers there?
Well, some of the teachers were like Dick Ayers was one of our teachers. Hi Eisman, who I think is still there, was one of our teachers. Who else? I'm blanking on the names. Joe was there. This was the second year. I would have been in the second graduating class, although I only did go 1 year, so I did not graduate. Joe was there, and he would teach our class occasionally, but he was not he taught the first year students, or I should say the first class. So he was with the second year students when I was a first year student. So I did not have a lot of direct exposure with Joe. Some, but not a lot.
And one of the things that I often talk about, when I was in high school, I went to a high school outside of town of 250 people.
Wow, okay.
Near Peoria, Illinois. So while everybody else was looking up to rock stars, I was looking at the comics and to meet Jack Kirby and Steve Gerber and Doug Mensch and Paul Galassi. These were my rock stars. When you started meeting the people who did comics, were you a little starstruck, or were you pretty much going, tell me how you do this?
No, I would say to this day, I think one of my big problems is I am always starstruck. I'm starstruck by, even people younger than me who started after me who are just amazing talents. I mean, the talent in this industry has always just amazed me. And I'm lucky enough to call some of these people friends. I've been lucky enough to meet some people, like Herb Trimpe. I got to spend a great evening with him at a convention. But generally, I'm fairly starstruck. But I think with only a very few exceptions, these guys have all been great and great to hang out with and very generous and very encouraging. And, it's really a great business, a great industry to be in.
One of the things I mentioned to people, you always hear never meet your heroes. When I ran the convention here in Minneapolis and, I've taken part in the conventions here for years and years and years, I've met a lot of people that I kind of looked up to,
right,
and I've had correspondence with them, and not a one has disappointed me, and in many cases, they're much kinder and much more appreciative than you would think people in other industries.
Right. I think so, too. I think so, too.
And very, very giving with advice.
Mm-hmm.
Very giving with, when you're doing a story, here's how you do the rising action. Here's how you handle the third act plot twist sort of thing. I was on a discussion list with Steve Gerber, and it's a shame that he didn't teach writing because the man knew everything about putting together a story.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
So when you started writing comics, who were the people who, you said that you were married to the editor at the time, but who were some of the people who kind of came along and helped you learn how to put a story together, especially when, in the late 80s, everything was soap opera, and now it's more complete novel-type story?
Yeah. Well, I will say obviously the people I admired as a fan influenced me. Stan Lee and Kniff, probably the two biggest writers who influenced me. But, Mike Carlin certainly did a lot of tap dancing on my head. A lot of the the rules I have for putting together a good story came right from Mike Carlin. You know, he was very good at teaching, some very basic things, but things that no one had really explained to me before. And then since just, talking with Kurt Busiek, talking with Mark Waid, I think both of those people have helped me see things that I should have seen earlier or more clearly. They both have very clear visions and clear understanding of writing. I will admit, and I think Kurt was the first person to point this out to me. A lot of what I do is very instinctive, and sometimes I don't know why I'm doing it, and sometimes that means I get lost. That's the problem with that. And then Kurt can come in and can look at what I've done and then Kurt will go, this and this and this kind of mean this, so why don't you try that? You know what I mean? Kurt yeah. can see the structure where all I'm just going is, well, I thought it would be kind of cool if they did this. And, I work very instinctively many times. And my friends and colleagues have really helped me learn the structure of a story much more than I ever knew before.
Another thing that kind of pops out at me is you've worked with group projects and on big projects, whereas, let's say you're writing a novel, it's just you, but you've done stuff like you inked the history of the DC Universe, which was a huge project. You were involved in Final Night, the Superman books. It's okay, we've got this huge creative team, and while everybody's working on their own story, they all have to blend and interact.
Right.
Which do you prefer? Do you prefer working with a big group of people or kind of doing it on your own?
I think there's places for both, isn't there? I mean, I really enjoyed working on the Superman books, especially at the start. It was a magic time. Carlin, the reason we worked well together is Carlin picked good people. He picked compatible people. I mean, I know Dan has flattered me more than once by saying, the minute I walked into the summit room, it was like I'd always been there. He said I fit right in. I'm very honored that he says that. But we just were firing on all cylinders. I just cannot tell you how many times I saw someone make someone else's idea better in those summits. It happened constantly. Now the problem with that is, none of us could do really continued stories. Anything we were doing, we had to finish more or less in 22 pages, and there's a lot of limitation there. If you wanted to really go in a different direction, you really couldn't. So there are some big drawbacks. I do think within the structure of the Superman books, there was enough latitude that I was very happy and could 9 times out of 10 do what I really kind of wanted to do. Carlin was very lenient sometimes. And I think not just to me, to everyone. He let everyone have some of their own space to play in, which was great. And on the other hand, it's really nice to do something like Section Zero that is yours, that is, that speaks to a more personal level, my interest in the Loch Ness Monster and ley lines and all this just weird stuff that exists in the zeitgeist that I just think still, in 2000 it was not as well known or as explored in comics as it is now. Now I can think of half a dozen comics that explore this sort of stuff. But, there's cultures from all around the world and they all have really weird beliefs and really strange beliefs and really scary beliefs. And believe me, all the comics out there haven't even begun to touch on what is, the possible story ideas that these legends and folklores and myths, have built into them.
I remember when I read Section Zero. Now, I tried to dig them up so that I could read those three issues. But like many people my age, it's like, finding these comics is just...
I got the same problem. I'll admit, I still have not found my copy of Section Zero number 2. I've got copies of 1 and 3, and I have a Xerox of issue 2 that I did my proofreading on. But I don't know where my printed copy of number 2 is.
But I remember at the time thinking,
it feels like kind of a cross between Kolchak the Night Stalker and Superheroes.
Yeah, I think that's not. I think that's a very fair assessment. I think a lot of times when I do the and this is what I should have done for the elevator pitch, it's Jack Kirby does the X-Files. It's
okay.
High octane, high adventure. You know, a team of people who investigate the strange and unknown. They basically wear jumpsuits. They mostly have no powers and rely on wits and maybe a little bit of luck and skill. But you know I do like a real energy to it. And it's Jack Kirby does the X-Files in many ways. I think that's the way most people could understand it easiest.
And Tom Grummett's art is just wonderful. I followed him since he first started in comics, and he's one of these artists who his characters look not just like people, but they're individualized.
Yeah, this is true.
And they carry through rather than this is generic hero guy, this is generic pretty girl, this is generic this. His characters have a lot of character to them.
Yeah, a lot of life. His characters, his figures really move. There's a lot of energy to his stuff. And I do think he's very adaptable. He can do darker things, you know, meaning spookier things. This is what I say about his style. His style is serious, but I can see that there's still a smile in it.
Yeah. And one of the things I wanted to ask is, in creating the characters, was this where you two sat down and sort of fleshed it out, or you created the characters and he got them and kind of brought them to life, and then maybe you adapted them a little to what he had drawn? What is the creative aspect?
Well, Tom and I are very simpatico, which is one of the great reasons why I like to work with him. And a lot of times I will say something to Tom and he will say, I've already been thinking the same thing, or I will say something to Tom and he will go, once again, making an idea better, how about this? And that's exactly how it was with Section Zero. I can't remember exactly how some of the characters were created. I think I probably came up with the Doc Challenger character. I know, I'm pretty sure Tom came up with the Sam Wildman character. How they ended up married, or I should say divorced, and you know, they used to be married, I'm not sure where that came from, but you know, I know the Sargasso character, he's our kind of creature from the Black Lagoon meets the Hulk. That was completely Tom, and I will say initially I didn't quite know how he fit into the team, and the story we're telling now, he is essential to it. This story could not exist without the Sargasso character. So, you know, these pieces all just seem to fall in place. I'm pretty sure the 24-hour bug character was my wacky character that I really wanted to have. I wanted to have a character who would kind of be able to do some jokes and wisecracks and supply a little humorous relief. And I just love the idea of a character named the 24-hour bug. And I'm a huge fan of the movie Them. I love giant ants. So in a way, this is also a tribute to that. So, but really, it all came together, you know, a little from him, a little from me, and that's how we've always worked.
I would be remiss if I didn't bring up what I think is one of the odder and more wonderful projects you worked on. There was a Captain America comic strip that nobody knew about until you discovered it.
Thank you.
And I wanted to know, was this something, because you've talked about your love of Milton Caniff and comic strips as well as comic books, was this something born out of that?
Oh, yes. I will say, I have done very little in my career, which I've written, penciled, and inked. But I wrote, penciled, and inked that whole miniseries. And it was a labor of love, every single line. And it was my love letter to the old Adventure comic strips, which I have, you know, I probably have more collections of old Adventure comic strips than I have collections of comic books. I mean, I have the comic books, but I buy very few of the collections. And, of course, the comic strips you can't really buy except in collections. But I, you know, I've got a lot of that stuff. And I've often thought, quite honestly, I wish I'd been born 50 years earlier so I could have done an adventure comic strip even more than doing comic books. There's something about those four panels. It's just enough to get you in and have something happen and hook you for the next day. And the pacing of that really appeals to me. The heightened drama of, you know, basically every four panels is a cliffhanger that is really exciting to me. And the stuff that you can accomplish in just a small amount of space, I find fascinating. I love the old comic strips to pieces. And this was my love letter to them, no doubt about it.
And often when I get previews and I see the IDW, there are times I think they're just publishing stuff for comic creators.
Yeah, well, tell me about it, yeah.
Because those artist editions, more artists talk about those than comic fans.
Yeah, exactly.
And for me, well, one of my friends who's an artist who doesn't work in comics, he works in film and TV and stuff, he just could not buy that the MAD artist edition fast enough.
Yeah. Well, if I was independently wealthy, I'd buy all of those artist editions, believe me.
And I've also noticed that a lot of comic creators who worked in comics in the 80s and 90s have moved into adventure strips. Terry Beatty's doing them. Mike Manley's doing them. Yeah. Joe Stanton's doing them.
Yeah, I will say, of all of those, Joe Stanton is the one I envy the most, doing Dick Tracy. He's perfectly suited for it. But I will admit there was a time when I heard that I believe Andrew Peepway had taken over Annie, and I was so jealous. I mean, I was not in the running. No one had even known I was interested in Annie. Annie, specifically Leonard Starr's Annie, was such a great strip. And quite honestly, if I had known, even though I heard the pay was horrible, but if I had known they were looking for someone to take over Annie, I would have like gotten on an airplane and flown to the Syndicate studios and stayed at their door until they gave it to me. Because I was so jealous when I heard Andrew Peepway was doing Annie.
And Andrew's a local boy. He's from Minneapolis originally. We had him at conventions every year. And it's always funny to me that he was doing that while inking bajillions of pages of the Simpsons stuff.
Yeah, well, yeah. So well,
what a wonderful way to show two different art styles.
I know. And once again, I'm jealous of people who can do that because I myself am not a man of many art styles. I am a man of maybe two art styles, and those two art styles are pretty similar, actually. So I'm very very envious of people who can switch gears and bring out different sides of themselves like that.
And you talked about the Captain America newspaper strip. You penciled it. Do you do a lot of penciling, and what are the different muscles that flexes rather than writing and or inking?
Well, I mean, inking is very technical, obviously. I always, in the past, I used to compare it to a cinematographer in a movie where my main job is to make sure I'm capturing the vision of the director, which in a comic is the penciler. But I actually think in modern comics, the colorist has taken over a lot of that responsibility, which was not the case in the 80s or before. But, you know, so inking is still very technical. I find it very relaxing. I enjoy it a lot. And I enjoy just the feel of ink on paper. I cannot buy into digital inking yet.
I was going to ask about that, if you've made the transition to digital.
When I'm penciling, I will do layouts, which I will manipulate digitally so that, you know, oh, this figure needs to be a little bigger, oh, his head's too small, you know, that sort of thing. I love how you can manipulate your image digitally, but to do the finished pencils, to do the inks, I print those out. And even all the inks I do, actually starting on Section Zero in 2000, the first run, that was when I first started inking on blue lines because the FedEx bills were killing us. They were so expensive. And Barry Kitson had started sending his pages electronically to his inker for Empire, and he told me how to do it, and Tom and I started doing it on Section Zero, and I never looked back. I've inked maybe a handful of pages on the original pencils since 2000.
Now, do you have any upcoming appearances at conventions and stuff where people can go and buy work from you directly?
Well, not many, because I've been focused totally on the Kickstarter, which is a full-time job, believe me. And I know I'll be at Rose City when that happens later this year. And I believe, I don't even know the dates of the Rose City Comic Con. But I also have committed to go to the Saskatoon Expo, which is in September, mid-September. And that's going to be a big, nice reunion with Tom Grummett, because Saskatoon is his home turf.
Oh, okay.
So I got invited up there, and I'm looking forward to that. Those might be my only two shows that I've committed to this year. And quite honestly, that's because I've been, working on putting this Kickstarter together for months in my spare time, and I'm working on it in all my spare time right now to promote it and to reach our goal. And once we reach our goal, I'm going to be working full time to get the book done.
And one of the reasons we're recording this late is you have kids that you're taking care of.
Yes. Yeah, we have two small children who had to go to bed before I could talk to you.
And as someone who raised a son on his own a few years ago, so that now when I'm, the age that we are, I can't imagine having the energy to put up with small children.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, my wife and I are both older parents. I adopted our son when I was 52. We both feel that we are much wiser than we would have been as parents, as younger parents, that in many ways we might be able to deal with some of the things that are coming our way a lot better, but we do have a lot less energy than we would have had. And I will tell you, especially the older the kids get, meaning they're now at the age where, they like to stay pretty active on the weekends. I can hardly wait for Monday to show up so I can sit down again, And it's great. We have a lot of fun. We do a lot of hiking. It's really fun that the kids are getting old enough that they can hike. Our daughter is just turned 3 last December. Our son just turned 5 last week. And he loves to hike. So we do a lot of that in the good weather. And in the bad weather, which Portland has its share of, we spend a lot of time inside these children's play areas that I never knew existed before. That's how we spend a lot of our time.
And what is it like as a parent to see the new versions of characters that you've worked on that have been repackaged, reimagined for young children?
I think that's really nice. I mean, I certainly I'm not up on all of them. Although on Free Comic Day, my daughter did get the DC Superhero Girls comic, which she seems to enjoy a lot. So books like that, I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful that there's stuff like that for girls like her. My son is on a huge Pokemon kick right now, but he also fell in love with the Skylanders comics that Ron Mars wrote.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I had no idea what Skylanders were at all. I still really don't know where they came from. Did they come from a video game? I'm not sure.
Yeah, they're a video game. Back, now I'm going to show my age, 20 years ago there was this video game called Spyro the Dragon.
Right. He's one of the characters, yeah.
Which was a, kind of a 3D platformer aimed at younger kids, but it was well made enough that, older people could play it. And that kind of faded out till they realized, hey, if we do something where the kids have to collect things.
Yeah.
Little kids love collecting. That's where the Skylanders came from.
Oh, well, we just took one of the books that IDW did, one of the comics. We got it out of the library. And I will say my wife picked it up. And I looked at it and I said, oh, this is going to be too much for Isaac. This was even now a couple of years ago, so he was probably like 3 years old when we first got it. But I read it to him at night and he loved it. He just ate it up. So we've collected, all of the Skylander graphic novels that IDW put out. And now we have Netflix and there's a Skylander TV series that they're watching. And yeah, my son loves Skylanders.
And I have to ask, because I think kids are kind of born loving Batman, are your kids kind of Batman crazy, or did that just not hit them as much?
I don't, you know, I mean, yeah, my son has Lego Batmans. We went to see the Lego Batman movie. I don't think it means much to my daughter. Maybe that is because she's a girl. Maybe that's because of her age. I would not say my son is Batman crazy. I don't think he differentiates much between Batman and the other superheroes. Although I will tell, I'm going to change that. We do at night before he goes to bed, we tell a story. He always wants me to tell him a story. And the deal, what this has evolved into is he gets to pick four superheroes and himself to have an adventure with. And then I decide on some threat or situation that they have to deal with. And between the two of us, we figure out how to solve the problem. And, I will say he rarely picks Batman to be on his team. He always picks the Flash. He always picks Hulk. And he generally picks Captain America and Iron Man.
Because of the movies, probably. They're kind of big in the public consciousness.
Well, it has to be public consciousness because we have not shown him those movies. But, I mean, when we were at the comic store the other day, which really was... We went on Free Comic Book Day, but it was packed. It was so packed. We didn't stay. And so I wanted to take the kids back on a more normal day because I had promised them if there was a book that they liked, I would buy it for them. So we went back, and Isaac just started running around the store, and he was going, "Look what I found! Look what I found!" And one of the things he found was a toy model of the Star Wars Death Star. And he points right at it and goes, "Look, Daddy, the Death Star." And I'm going, he's never seen Star Wars. How does he know that?
It's funny how that stuff just sort of sinks in almost intrinsically.
I know. But
you go to Target, and if you go down certain aisles, it's like, wow, that's a lot of Iron Man and a lot of Captain America and a lot of Spider-Man.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, I've read him. Some of the, you know, Avengers adventure books and stuff like that are aimed at the younger children. So I understand that he knows those characters. I don't understand how he knows Death Star. I just don't understand. although I wonder, and I'm beginning to suspect he might be beginning to read and doesn't even realize it yet. I think there's certain words that he's recognizing the same way he would recognize Batman's face. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
So, and I'm not sure if Death Star falls into that, but I, you know, more than once he has named something and I go, "I didn't tell you the name of that. How do you know the name for that?" You know?
Well, being as how you're a father now, have you put any thought to doing kids' comics or kids' stories or things like that? Because one of the things that I find fascinating is just how much money there is in the YA novels and things aimed at teenagers and younger kids that it seems Marvel and DC just kind of don't know how to market to.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I mean, when you look at, if I'm not mistaken, I think, you know, the best-selling graphic novels of the last year were aimed at young adults, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And all I would say is that could be in my future. Well, we will just have to see. I cannot say I have something very specific in mind right now. That I would say, yeah, I got this young adult idea just sitting in my back pocket, burning a hole in it. But I think my sensibilities would suit that pretty well. And so all I have to do is hit on the idea that strikes me as the right idea. So.
Well, your Kickstarter, what is the date it ends here? Let's get that date.
It ends on
June 1st.
Is it June 1st?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a Thursday, right?
Yes,
Thursday, June 1st, it ends on, yes. And that we're almost at the halfway point, and we're almost at the halfway point funding-wise, too. And I know that means we have a long way to go, and all I can say is we're going to do everything we can to make this a successful Kickstarter because we want this book to get out there more than anyone else. And, Tom Grummett, bless his heart, he's never been on social media before, and he now has an Instagram account, and he's been posting daily Section Zero sketches and other characters. He's doing what he can from up in Saskatoon, and I'm beating the bush on Twitter and on Facebook and any place like this that'll have me, you know. I think we got a great product. I know it's a product we're pouring our heart and soul into. I know it's going to be a fun book. I know it'll be an exciting book. And I think people would just really love it, is all I can say.
And reading your work and Tom's work over the years, anytime you two get together, it's magic. Anytime you get together, it's magic. I want to thank you for coming on the show. I am turning this thing around in 2 days because I'm that excited about this book.
Wow, thanks.
So if you're listening to this, please go. It's the easiest way to find it is just to go to Kickstarter, put in Section Zero or put in Carl Kessel, and it pops right up.
Yep.
The rewards, you got some killer rewards here. You've got, let's see, I think some of the ones I like, at $45, you get to vote on what tattoo you're going to get.
Yep, that's true. we give away temporary tattoos at that level, and of those four designs, anyone that pledges at that level or above gets to vote on which of those four designs I get on my body as a real tattoo. I get to choose placement. That is not left up to other people. But I will certainly do that. I would gladly do that. I already know the tattoo artist who would do it. He's done a number of cartoonists here in the Portland area. So
At $25, you're going to get the book. You're also going to get your name in the book.
Yeah.
As a PDF of the book.
Yeah. Yeah, at 25, yeah, when you get your name in the book, anyone who pledges $10 or more gets their name as an alleged supporter of Section Zero.
Let's see. I'm going to look at some of the high-end ones here. You've got a retailer for $125. So if you're a retailer, I know a lot of retailers get a little hinky about Kickstarter because they feel that you're going around them.
Right.
But more and more comic creators are doing this where it's, hey, if you back this, we're going to send you a retailer pack.
Right, exactly. And that's what we want to do too. I mean, I am not anti-comic store. I just am pro-creator-owned comics, and I want to find a way that we can all be happy together. And I have no problem with the retailer level. We actually have two of them. The one you mentioned is for the signed edition of the book. There's a slightly lower priced retailer level for the unsigned edition of the book. And but I will do everything I can. We did get one order from a retailer, which is quite large. And I would be more than willing to talk to him about arranging a signing because he's put in quite a large order.
And one of the things about this isn't going to be, you know, I've done some Kickstarters where you're pledging $10 and you get a regular, you know, just a comic book. This is a thick trade paperback, complete story.
Right.
Finishing a story that you started back a long time ago.
17 years ago.
So this is one you've had in your head for a while.
Yeah, the exact details of the story have changed because 17 years went by, but the changes, quite honestly, have made it a better story. I think I'm a better writer. I have a better idea of where these characters are going and what obstacles to throw in their way, quite honestly. It's going to be – the book itself will be about 200 pages long. About 160 or 70 of that will be story. Then we have some behind-the-scenes stuff. Kurt Busiek said he has agreed to write an introduction. We have 10 killer pinups by some of the most amazing artists in the industry today. And that's all in the book itself. If you pledge higher, we have a Gorilla dossier, which is Section Zero characters drawn by the original artist of Gorilla Comics, which is George Perez and Barry Kitson and Stuart Immonen, and Mike Robringo. Mike, unfortunately, is, of course, not with us anymore, but I found a sketch of his that I was able to adapt into a Section Zero character so that we could include Mike in that dossier.
That's wonderful. I'm going to name these artists who are doing pinups because this is something – I think this is a great sales point. You got Walt Simonson. You got John Paul Leon. You got Ben Caldwell, Kelly Jones, Matthew Clark, Jerry Ordway, Terry Dodson, Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, one of the kindest human beings I've ever met in my life.
Yeah.
Chris Samney and Dave Gibbons.
Yeah.
That's a murderer's row right there.
Well, thank you. I mean, I was amazed when every single one of those people said yes. I will probably say the biggest the most bowl over moment to me was when Garcia Lopez agreed, when Jose agreed, because I don't know the man at all. We've worked in the industry side by side sometimes for like 30 years. I think one time I did a backup story in an Atari Force that he did the main story in. But I've never really met him. I've just loved his work forever. And I cold called him basically through Messenger on Facebook. And he said, yes, I'd love to. So, and Tom and I were like going, Garcia Lopez!
We've had him here at the show, too. And one of the things I think is fascinating is, you know, comic fans will come up and get stuff, but the artists all, like, swarm. He's like an artist that artists
just
love.
He's an artist artist, yes. Why he is not, you know, basically, you know that B. Kleiban comic strip about, you know, out of the way, human, here comes an artist. You know that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what Garcia Lopez should, his life should be like that.
When he comes to Minneapolis, it kind of is. And the thing that I always point to is if you've seen a DC character outside of comics for the past 30 years, he drew it.
Yeah, yeah. He's the style guide guy, you know, which, you know, unfortunately sells his storytelling abilities short, which are fantastic. But, there's nothing he can't do. There's nothing he can't do.
And I would say the same thing for your work. Like I said, I've followed your work for a long time. Your Kirby influence pops out at me because I'm such a huge Kirby fan. I've done, 10 podcasts where I just go through, all right, here's what Kirby was doing between 1971 and 1973.
Yeah.
And all of the stuff that you put in, it shows this deep love of his work and an understanding of his characters that rather than just going back and retelling the stories, you take what he did, adapt it for modern times and still understand what was behind it so that it works in every era. And I really want to thank you for that.
Well, thanks. I do try to do that. And I don't think I always succeed, but I like to know that it's good to know that I've succeeded at least a good amount of time. Thank you very much.
And if you ever get that Goody Rickles story approved.
Yeah. Since it's really not Goody Rickles, it was, I could still do it. I will say one of the creator-owned books that I would like to do in the future is, you know, kind of my superhero book. And I could easily do that story in my superhero book if I ever got to that point.
And just that Mark Evanier says that the idea was, okay, Don Rickles makes fun of the powerful. Is there anybody more powerful than Superman? And then you read the story, and you never get that because Kirby had all these other ideas that just piled on top of it.
I know. It's,
It's beautiful. It's just beautiful. And thank you again for the years and years and years of wonderful comics. And just I know inkers don't get a lot of praise, but you're one of those inkers that always brings forth the art and makes it a little bit better. Makes it come off the page a little bit more. And I wanted to thank you for that as well.
Well, thank you very much. I do try to do that. I do.
So go sign up for that Kickstarter. I am signing up the minute I am done recording. I want you to sign up for it too because I want this book.
Thank you very much, Corey. I want this book too, believe me. And we appreciate everyone who helps us out in any way possible.
And that is an interview with Carl Kessel. If you listen to the episode, you got a laundry list of stuff that if you haven't read, you should go out and pick up. There were a few things that I didn't touch on. His time writing the Fantastic Four. He did a couple short stories in the Fantastic Four that I enjoyed. Carl was a delight to interview. This is episode 4 in a five podcast week. If I can talk, you can tell I've been podcasting all week because I'm stumbling over my own words. Tomorrow, Saturday, believe it or not, will be the next episode of Novelcast. Things got delayed because work called me in a few times, and I had to delay doing some mixing because they needed me at work. But Novelcast returns tomorrow, and that's over at novels.solitairerose.com. Matter of fact, if you want to know a little more about the Solitaire Rose Network, here are our ads. That's right, here at the Solitaire Rose Radio Network, we have ads, and our first sponsor is Me, that's right, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. I have my first book out with Dangerous Dan Moore. It's the first 100 strips of our online web strip, Worldwide News, the story of the lowest rated cable news network. And you can get yourself a copy with commentary, with all sorts of extras, with signatures and everything. Just email Dan over at lordshadowflame@gmail.com. Our top sponsor, who's been with us since day one, is DreamHost. DreamHost.com. You need yourself a website, and DreamHost.com is the number one web host in the whole known universe. Just head over to DreamHost.com, put in the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, get $20 off your first year. How can you beat that? Our other sponsor is Graze, G-R-A-Z-E.com. Healthy snacks for a healthy lifestyle. Just head over to Graze, put in the code CORYS3R5P. Your first and fifth box are free. You can get them weekly. You can get them bi-weekly. You can get them monthly. You just order a whole bunch of them. It's great stuff to keep you away from the vending machine at work. Now, if you would like to leave a comment for any of the podcasts that we do, we'd love those. Go ahead and email us at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com, or you can call 952-856-0519. Operators are standing by. Okay, it's just a place that will record your calls, but we'll play them on the air. We'll answer your questions. We love getting feedback. Tell us what you think. Ask a question. Suggest a topic. Be a guest. Send us your stuff. SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. If you would like to advertise on any of the Solitaire Rose radio shows, you can. Just email us at SolitaireRoseNetwork@gmail.com. Subject: advertising. Thanks. A lot coming up in the next few weeks. Joe and I do crazy comics and stories here at this URL every Monday. Every Monday we do a new episode. We have done 300 episodes, and we still get together every week and talk funny books. Solitaire Rose Radio comes out from time to time. Two episodes this week. Tomorrow is the Minneapolis St. Paul Spring Con, or MSP Comic Con, over at the St. Paul Fairgrounds. If you're in the area, head on over. It's a two-day show, biggest and best show in the Twin Cities. Be there. Aloha. We also had an episode of Bad Advice with myself and Wolfie B. Bad. So a lot of stuff came out this week. A lot of stuff coming up in the next few weeks. We've got new episodes of Series in Review coming out. We've got more interviews coming up. We've got more episodes of Novelcast. All sorts of things coming from the Solitaire Rose Network. Want to thank you for listening. If you want to help the show, visit our sponsors and then tell everyone you've ever known your whole entire life about the podcast we do here at the Solitaire Rose Network. I really appreciate the growth we've had over the last 6 months. It's really, really been heartwarming to see not just the numbers going up, but the number of people who've been retweeting and sharing on Facebook and sharing in social media, and also emailing myself and Joe and asking us questions, but also telling us how much the show means to them and how much they like what we talk about. So keep those cards and letters coming, kids, and we'll be back soon with more stories. Ow! Another fine podcast from Solitaire Rose Networks.
The end.